everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we are going to be talking about Season 5, Episode 22, Swan Song, the final episode of Season 5, the last episode of Kripke era, even though he continues on the show for a while, written by Eric Kripke, with a story credit to Eric Giz Gerwitz, directed by Steve Boyum. Here we finally are on the precipice of toppling headfirst into the final act of Kripke's original vision for the series. And if you believe he had any of this planned out before, like, early season 4, then I have a bridge to sell you. Kripke's original vision for the series was nothing like what it turned into by the end of season 5. My personal hatred of this episode didn't truly come to fruition until I read Kripke's script for it, and I will provide you a link to do the same yourself if you so choose. I always thought it was kind of mediocre story-wise, but oh my god, the self-congratulatory backpatting that Kripke pulls in the script, like in the notes in the script, just soured me on the story more than I'd believed was humanly possible before I read it. If you do choose to read it, gird yourself before you read the scenes that take place at Stull. Kripke really is Chuck. Chuck really is Kripke up to this point, even if the nebulous network took over Chuck's place in the story in later seasons. This episode is why I can't watch a Kripke series anymore. I have not watched anything he's produced. I watched the first season of Revolution, and that's the last thing I ever watched that he did. I was like, nah, I'm just done with this guy. Which is pretty ironic for me to say as someone who's been watching a single Kripke series on a continuous loop for more than a decade. I get that I can be irrational, but anyway. For folks groaning because this means we're moving out beyond Kripke era and into the land of the terrible Gamble era, just know that Kripke did stay on for season 6 as a consultant, helped craft the story arc of the season, he wrote the season 6 finale, and helped craft the story arc for season 7. The much maligned season 7 was still a product of Kripke's brain, at least in part, before he moved on to Revolution. So, everyone who complains that the show would have been better if Kripke had stayed, just know that it finally kind of started to get better after he really truly left. Just so you know. I think everyone knows the general storyline of this episode, since it tops so many favorite episode lists and greatest episode lists, and I don't really need to go through telling you what to expect. I think it's safe to just start at the road so far and enjoy, if enjoy is the right word for this experience. Carry on, wayward son. We open the road so far with Sam and Dean back at the season 4 finale, watching Lucifer erupt in a beam of light. And then we get a montage of monsters they've fought, Dean driving through heaven. We get Gabriel from changing channels telling them to suck it up and play the roles that destiny has chosen for them. Sam and Dean learning that they are Lucifer and Michael's vessels respectively and both being completely against the idea. We get everything from a montage of different horsemen they've conquered to Dean in the Endverse. And a reminder that for some bizarre reason he chose to give Lisa the heads up that something terrible was going to be coming their way and to just hold tight knowing that she'd be protected. And it's just like, okay, why randomly bring back this woman he, you know, has spent a collective, like, 3 days of his life with? It's just kind of weird. We then get Gabriel's voice overlay of the cage that you sprung Lucifer from still exists. You can shove his ass back in. And the key to the cage is the rings from the four horsemen. We get the reminder that Adam was resurrected, and he was nothing like the ghoul they met the first time around, and he sadly ended up being the accidental vessel of Michael. He was completely manipulated by the angels into it. And then Sam talking about his plan to Bobby the first time, that what if you lead Lucifer to the edge and I drag him in. And Bobby reacting to that most disappointedly, aggressively disappointedly, the explosion that killed Ellen and Joe, and Dean accepting Death's ring in exchange for doing what has to be done and letting Sam jump into the pit. The final scene of the montage is the last scene from last week's episode of Bobby telling Dean, "What are you afraid of? Losing or losing your brother?" And honestly, either way, he's going to lose his brother because, you know, end of the world. But one way, they lose on their own terms. The other way, Sam's diving into an eternity in hell trapped with Lucifer, which sounds very unpleasant. That's where we come to now. An entirely different montage. The overlay of Chuck's voice narrating his story. And you can tell just by the tone of his voice that this isn't about a writer just transcribing. This doesn't sound like a prophet who's just the vessel for this information to have come to him, you know? This sounds like a storyteller crafting the story in a very specific way. Chuck makes the salvation of the universe all about the car. So, like, no wonder it ended up in heaven. It's the most important object in the entire universe, and I will not argue with that. But the way Chuck is writing it is making it that. We learn Baby's history from her original owner being Sal Moriarty, a combination of two of the main characters in On the Road, Dean Moriarty and Sal Paradise. And originally Kripke had intended to name the characters in Supernatural Dean and Sal, but he ended up naming him Sam instead. So Kripke finally got to use that specific reference. The original owner of the car drove around giving Bibles to the poor to get people right for Judgment Day. And then Chuck adds that Sam and Dean don't know any of this, but if they did, I'm sure they'd smile. And you know what? I don't think they would. I think they'd be weirded out by that, Chuck. So we know how the story begins, when John bought the car on Dean's advice. And Chuck has declared that this is where the story ends. Only it doesn't. It keeps going for another decade after this. We then cut to Bobby's scrapyard, where Sam is just lounging on the hood of the car, drinking a beer. Dean walks up, pulls a beer out of the green cooler, can barely even look at Sam, but Dean tells him, "I'm in." And Sam's like, "What, you're gonna let me say yes to Satan?" And Dean's like, "No, because it's not on me to let you do anything." Sam's like, "That's the last thing I thought you'd ever say." Dean's like, "Hey, it might be." But he continues talking. You know, Sam can make his own choices and Dean doesn't have to like it. It goes against every fiber of his being to let this happen without a fight. But Sam's an adult, and if this is what he thinks is the right thing to do, Dean will support him. Dean confesses that since they were children, his job has always been protecting Sam. And he says, "No, it's more than that. It's kind of who I am." Dean also tells him that if anybody could bring the devil under his control and drag him into the pit, he believes in Sam's ability to be that person, whether they have an actual chance or not. And then he asks Sam, "Is this really what you want?" And I mean, let's be honest, Dean, I don't think anybody would want that. But Sam's sense of responsibility sort of makes him feel obligated. He's like, "I let him out. I've got to put him back in." And then we cut to the title card. You know, they were both manipulated into everything that happened that brought about them letting Lucifer out. Dean breaking the first seal, Sam breaking the last. It's not like they were given choices about it, knowing what the outcomes would be or knowing what their choices were even leading them to. They were told the opposite would happen, that they would stop the apocalypse if they did these things, and yet they happened anyway. Being lied to and manipulated, put in this position by a destiny built so long before they were even thought of as people, it's not on them to fix everything, and it should never have been. And yet they've been driven to this out of this manufactured necessity because Chuck won't stand up and do the right thing for his own creation. He wants everybody to have to go through the same test that he believed he needed to do. And there we are. One brother must kill the other, or one brother must die so that the other can live free and happy, and never really free or happy. So Sam, Dean, and Cass have clearly drained a couple of demons of their blood, and they've got gallons, like plastic gallon jugs filled with blood. It's pretty horrifying. And the look on Dean's face as the camera closes in on him as Sam and Cass are stowing the blood is just, this is really what it's come to, isn't it? This thing that he's been fighting against in his brother for the last two seasons, this demonic influence. And he's basically green-lighted Sam to go full throttle back into that addiction as well. Dean detours over to talk to Bobby, and Bobby asks Dean if he's okay, and Dean's like, not really, what do you got? So at least he's being honest and not going with, fine. He can't even lie to that extent about how he's doing. Bobby'd been gathering news reports of weird things like, where might Lucifer be? Looking for demonic omens. And he lists off a couple of dramatic things happening around the country. And one of the places is Detroit, where there was a 20-degree temperature drop in a 5-block area of downtown Detroit. Dean's like, yep, that's the one. And Bobby's like, really? That's not really all that much. You're serious that you're going to overlook like a hurricane and earthquakes and stuff for a 20-degree temperature drop? And Dean's like, nope, Detroit, that's where it's always going to happen. Going all the way back to 5-4, it's always going to happen in Detroit. That's where Sam gave Lucifer the big yes in that universe. And even in this universe, in 5-10 Abandon All Hope, Lucifer tells Sam, oh no, I think you're going to say yes. And it's going to happen within 6 months in Detroit. So they both have now been told by a version of Lucifer that Detroit is where it goes down. As they're driving through the night, Dean looks in the back seat at Cass, all slumped over asleep, and is like, aw, ain't he a little angel? Sam turns around and looks and is like, except angels don't sleep. Meaning Cass is mostly human. And Dean is unsettled by that. He tells Sam that he's got a bad feeling about everything they're doing, from the demon blood to driving to Detroit. Everything, all of it, saying yes. Dean does not believe that it's going to work. Dean is really unsettled about the fact that it's Detroit, that maybe Lucifer is rolling out the red carpet for them, knowing things that are going to happen that they don't have any idea of yet. Like, this is one big trap. And Sam's like, I'm sure he knows a lot of things we don't, but we just got to hope he doesn't know about the rings. Spoiler alert, Lucifer knew about the rings, even though Gabriel didn't think he did. But this quiet moment on the road is when Sam chooses to have their serious talk. He tells Dean, if this works, I'm not going to be coming back. So Sam extracts some promises from Dean. You've got to promise not to try to bring me back. Dean is furious about this. He's like, what? Your tour is going to be so much worse than mine. And it's eternal. You can't think that I would just let you rot in there forever. That I wouldn't try something to get you back out again. And Sam's like, no, you can't go poking at the cage once it's shut. It's too risky that Lucifer might escape if you try and save me. Dean's like, you can't ask me to do this. And Sam's like, I'm sorry, you have to. You don't have a choice. And there it is again. You don't have a choice. Worst phrase on the show. The opposite of free will is happening here. And finally, Dean's like, yeah, there's no point arguing this. So what am I supposed to do if I'm not supposed to even try to save you? And that's when Sam comes on with the, you gotta go find Lisa and beg her to take you in. Sam pushes him to live that normal apple pie life. And see, that's Sam's lifelong dream. That's what Sam always wanted for Sam. He couldn't understand why Dean didn't want the same sort of life. That is never a life that Dean has wanted. He's had little soft visions of it, like, oh yes, that might be nice for a day or two. And then he's right back to going antsy pants because he needs to go out and hunt something. And he will stick it out for a year because he promised Sam he would. And I will never forgive Sam for making Dean make this promise. It ruined so many people's lives. Dean's looking all like soft focus at the future and wondering what that might actually be like for just a second. And then Sam barks at him, promise me! Like, you go do that thing that you've never expressed wanting to do. It's one of the worst things that Sam ever does to Dean in the entire series, and I hate it to death. Dean just looks over at him. He doesn't say, yeah, man, I'll promise. He doesn't reply at all. He just looks pretty damn grim about it. So they get to Detroit, and Bobby scouts out a dozen or two demons. He's like, well, yeah, there's definitely something up here. And Dean's just intent. He's like, nope, he's here. I know he is. From the looks on everybody's faces, it's like they think this might be their last showdown, that the whole thing is ending right here, right now. And we know we're only less than 10 minutes into this episode. This can't possibly be the end yet. Of course not. We know how television works. While Dean stalks around to open the trunk full of demon blood that he's disgusted by, the whole idea of it, and everything surrounding it, Bobby gets his little goodbye session with Sam. He tells Sam, see you around, kid. And Sam replies, see you around. And they embrace. And it's like, they both know they're not going to see each other around. Bobby advises Sam to fight tooth and nail, keep swinging, don't give an inch. And Sam replies, yes, sir. I don't know if they've ever called Bobby sir before, but it's an acknowledgement that he sees Bobby as his father figure. In a way that the yes, sir, that was automatic to John as a child and then that he rebelled against. Yeah, he chose to give that title to Bobby now. Sam then walks over to Cass with a hand extended, like, everybody else gets hugs, you get a handshake. He tells Cass, take care of these guys, okay? And Cass is just like, oh, Sam, there's nothing I can do to take care of them. Because, I mean, Cass is still wallowing in his own, I don't have any powers, I'm just a useless human. And Sam's just like, humor me. Like, this is what we say, like, you know, how he exchanged the see you around kid with Bobby, knowing that it's not true. You say something nice in a going away, and Cass is learning that little lesson about humanity. Cass is like, oh, sure, yeah. Then he goes back around to the trunk of the car where Dean is waiting for him with all of the demon blood. And Sam asks Dean to not watch this. And Dean's like, dive into hell or however you prefer here, I guess. Because to Dean, not only letting Sam have demon blood, but giving it to him actively feels like something that weighs on him. He spent so long trying to save Sam from it. It was the reason that Lucifer's free in the first place, was Sam's addiction and manipulation through the demon blood. A short time later, Sam has apparently drunk 4 gallons of demon blood. He slams the trunk shut and then determinedly walks past Dean. And it's like a subtle change has come over Sam just from consuming that much demon blood. He's like, okay, let's go. And doesn't even stop to glance at Dean. I mean, maybe he would have broken emotionally if he had tried. Or maybe the demon blood is just driving him to this purpose. And Dean is incredibly skeptical. While Sam might be supremely confident in his ability to do this, I mean, obviously he has doubts about his overall ability to wrestle Lucifer, but Sam believes this is the way, that this is the only way to save the entire universe. And Dean is like, man, I just think this is all kinds of wrong. And maybe they did tear up the pages, and maybe this is a product of their free will, but man, it really doesn't feel like it when you look at the bigger picture, does it? Sam walks up to the building where all the demons are, and he's like, here I am, come and get me, basically. Sam and Dean are unceremoniously escorted upstairs, where Lucifer is standing in the window waiting for them. And he's looking way worse for wear, even worse than he did the last time we saw him in Hammer of the Gods. Just absolutely vessel going decrepit on him. We then cut back to Chuck's narration about the car, seen through rose-colored glasses about Sam and Dean's emotional attachment to it, how they basically lived in it, grew up in it, and put all these little details into it, from the hatch in the trunk where all the weapons are hidden, to the army man that was crammed in an ashtray, and the Lego bricks that are dumped in the heating vent. It's also the first time we see the SW and DW being carved into the board underneath the carpeting in the car. That was never a thing before. None of this was. The army man, the Legos. This episode made them a thing because Chuck chose to mention them to us here. And that every time Dean rebuilt her, they showed the car getting smashed in the season one finale and Dean rebuilding her from basic bones. He put all of those things back the way they were. Put the Legos back in the heating vent. Put the army man back in the ashtray. Made sure to save their SW and DW carvings, even when the rest of the car was destroyed. Chuck ends by saying, "The devil doesn't know or care what kind of car the boys drive," as if that makes him ignorant of the biggest weapon that they have against him. And it's like, well, it was only made into that by Chuck's narration in this episode. The way Chuck can pull weapons out of anything and just declares, oh yeah, that'll do the thing. Anyway, it always bugs me that people are like, the story became this because, you know, their free will, they chose this and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, Chuck was writing it from the beginning of the episode. So it's like, this was his story. He's the one telling it. So that's how it happens. Back to Lucifer, though. He blows on the window and it ices over. He draws a little pitchfork in the frost. Most people think I burn hot. It's actually quite the opposite. Dean's like, oh, well, I'll alert the media. Dean does not know how to show fear in the face of danger. So Lucifer's like, okay, then why are you here? Sam's like, we don't want to fight you. I want to say yes. And Lucifer's like, come again? Sam closes his eyes and uses his newly rekindled demonic powers to snuff the lights out in the two demon goons who'd escorted them into the room. Sam keeps trying to say yes, and Lucifer's like, really, are you serious? And Sam is forced to reconfirm over and over in different ways that yes, he really means it. We see now, Judgment Day's a runaway train. We want off. Just let me say yes. Sam attempts to throw in some conditions. Okay, yes, we understand. When it's all over, I live, he lives, pointing to Dean. You bring our parents back. And then Lucifer cuts him off. He's like, okay, forget it, you know. And that's when Lucifer breaks the news that he knows Sam has the rings, the horseman's rings, and he knows exactly what they're for. Sam tries to remain defiant in the face of this, but Lucifer clearly knows all about it, and Dean just looks heartbroken. He looks sick. He's like, I knew this was a trap. I knew this was a mistake. I never should have agreed to this. We're totally fucked now. This was never a secret plan. This was never going to work. Lucifer says a few things here that I gotta say something about. Lucifer's like, I've never lied to you, Sam. You could at least pay me the same respect. And it's like, maybe you didn't lie, but man, you sure did deceive. You sure did withhold the truth. You sure did manipulate. You know, presenting yourself as with Jess's face the first time he showed himself to Sam. Like, maybe it was just a little bit manipulative, at the very least. And then Lucifer professes to like the idea of a one-on-one inside Sam's head wrestling match for who can take control. He's like, no tricks. You win, we'll jump in the hole. I win, then, well, I win. And that's what he said before, way back in Zachariah's vision from 5:4. I win because I win. And it always happened in Detroit. And here we are in Detroit. This has got to be shaking Dean so badly because the other thing from that vision, Cass essentially human, is happening as well. They've had to deal with a Croatoan outbreak, but at least they managed to stop that. But everything else seems to be playing out. And they already know that the cult won't work to kill Lucifer. So it would be a totally hopeless situation for Dean if this goes the way it's starting to look like it's about to. Dean is kind of hoping that Sam will just be like, ah, nah, fuck it, goodbye, and walk out. But Lucifer taunts Sam into it. It's like a fiddle of gold against your soul that says, I'm better than you. And Sam's like, no, I have this one chance to prove that I'm worth something. It doesn't matter if he knows about the rings. It doesn't matter because it's him versus me, and I'm definitely better than the devil. Or at least he's got to try to prove it, even if it kills him, you know? Dean is distressed. He's like, Sam, come on, don't do this. Don't do this. This was clearly a trap. And Sam says, we don't have any other choice. Dean's like, no. And there's nothing he can say. What other choice do they have? Where's the free will in this? And Sam says yes. Dean has to shield his eyes as Lucifer possesses his brother. We get a shot of Bobby and Cass standing outside on the street, watching the windows upstairs glow brightly, knowing that Lucifer has taken possession of Sam. And they give each other a look like, oh God, here we go. When the light fades and Dean opens his eyes again, Sam is lying on the floor, along with the demonic corpses, and I have to assume Nick's body, because there was no way Nick was still alive when Lucifer left him, because he was in really bad shape. I mean, remember Vince Vincente melting on stage when Lucifer left him? Kind of the same deal for Nick, which always offends me that they bring back Nick's body like it had just been lying around with its soul still trapped in it all this time. Like, what a horrific thought, you know? Yeah, I really hope that wasn't true. Anyway, Dean looks around, throws the rings at the wall, they stick like a magnet, and recites the spell to open the portal into the cage. When the portal opens, Dean rushes to help Sam to his feet. Sam's like, oh, I can feel him, oh! And knowing that it's actually Lucifer and not Sam at all, you can see the condescension on Jared's face as he plays it like he knows he's playing Lucifer here already, playing Sam. Dean's like, you gotta go now, Sammy, now. And Sam strides towards the wall, looking determined, and then just stops right before the portal. And it's like, Dean, why didn't you go shove your brother through the wall? Just get it over with and shove him in. He had plenty of time to do so. I mean, I don't think Lucifer would have actually led him. I think he would have, you know, turned around and launched him across the room, or launched Dean into the cage. And Sam turns around and he's like, well, Lucifer turns around and he's like, I'm just messing with you. Sam's long gone. And then he recites the spell to close the portal and just takes the rings with him. And then he turns to Dean and says, I told you this would always happen in Detroit. And then vanishes, leaving Dean with three corpses and no Sammy. And now they've lost everything. He hated the idea, but he was willing to let Sam jump into the cage. And they just failed. They completely failed. Lucifer, however, has taken Sam to visit a bunch of people he's known throughout his life, all gathered in this creepy old room, standing there just completely devoid of humanity. And this entire conversation plays out with Lucifer having allowed Sam to speak. And Sam only manifests in a broken mirror as Lucifer retains control of his body. Lucifer tries to manipulate Sam yet again. We're two halves of a whole. This has got to feel so good. I've been waiting for you for so long. And Sam's like, this is the opposite of good. And Lucifer's like, you can't lie to me. I'm inside your head. I can see everything. Lucifer pulls the sympathy card. I could always see how out of place you felt in that family of yours. You know, because Sam spent his lifetime trying to run away from it, probably because of some of the fear instilled in his father from the time Sam was 6 months old, and he began to have doubts about what his child even was, or what destiny had been assigned to him, or was he going to turn into a monster? Like, being raised like that could not have helped Sam feel welcome, part of the family, no matter how hard Dean tried. Lucifer describes the Winchester family as Sam's foster family at best, that Lucifer is his real family. All those times you were running away, you weren't running away from your family, you were running towards me. Now that he has control, Lucifer's like, look, this could be a good thing. I let Dean live, didn't I? And I can bring your folks back. I can give you all of that. Sam's like, I don't want anything from you. Lucifer's like, not even payback? Look at all these little devils. Any of them mean anything to you? And as Sam looks around the room at the motionless, possessed people standing around, they're all people he's known throughout his life. Everyone from his grade school teachers to friends he made to his prom date were all possessed by demons and sent to spy on him by Lucifer and his minions. Lucifer's trying to tell Sam that he's never really had free will. We've been controlling you since you were a small child. But he's playing into Sam's anger. He's like, I know how much you hate being leashed like that. I hate it too. What say you and I blow off a little steam? Like, we'll kill these demons together. That will feel good, won't it? Get revenge against them for using you your whole life? He blames Azazel for it. And it's like, dude, this was all part of your grand plan. You gave the orders. Meanwhile, back on the sidewalk near where Sam disappeared, Dean is reunited with Bobby and Cass, and they're watching breaking news from around the world in the window of a television shop. There's been earthquakes all over the place. The world is falling into hell. Quite literally. The apocalypse is coming to a head here. Dean asks Cass what they do now. Cass suggests they imbibe copious quantities of alcohol and wait for the inevitable blast wave. And Dean dismisses this. He's like, no, no, how do we stop it? And Cass looks at him like Dean's insane. He's like, we don't. There's no stopping this. It's the apocalypse. Because that was always the danger. If Sam said yes, both Michael and Lucifer now have their vessels. They're out of the loop now. They're just three humans on a sidewalk. Cass, Dean, and Bobby just, they played their last card and it failed, apparently. Cass is pretty convinced that Michael and Lucifer will meet on the field of battle and the world will end. And Dean's like, come on, there's got to be something we can do. Where's the battle going to be? And Cass is like, I don't know. There's nothing more we can do. Dean turns to Bobby and Bobby's like, well, we always knew it was kind of a long shot. And he's resigned himself as well to awaiting that inevitable blast wave. And Dean himself even looks pretty heartbroken and hopeless, like, no, no, this can't be it. But he has no idea what else to do either. We cut back to Sam and Lucifer sharing the body. And they have gone on their little killing spree. Lucifer managed to get Sam worked up enough to kill this room full of people. People he'd known in his childhood and teenage years. People he'd once cared about, maybe. Obviously, he cared at least a little bit about his prom date. The one we will find out in the end of season 8 that apparently she ended up with Dean instead on prom night. I guess that's what demons do. Who knows? But Sam gave in to that anger, just as Lucifer wanted him to. And he looks slightly horrified by the fact. This is not what Sam wanted at all. And on that note, we cut back to Chuck's narration with the soft flute music in the background. The idyllic Sam and Dean shots. The opening shot is Baby driving down the road that they used in Scarecrow in and out of the little town where the evil apple orchard was. I recognize the bridge. Chuck then talks about how they spent their downtime between hunts. Sam used to insist on honest work, but now he hustles pool. And Chuck frames it as like the freedom of the open road. They could go anywhere and do anything they wanted. I mean, there may have been tiny moments that we've seen of them just doing stuff like that, just driving because they wanted to or in a direction that they chose at random. But mostly we saw them barreling towards hunts to save people that they once drove 1,000 miles just to go to an Aussie show or 2 days just to go to a Jayhawks game. And it's like, okay, that's nice, but we never saw any of that. Just like we never saw the army man and the Legos in the car and their initials carved in the rear dashboard. It's like Chuck is now planting all of this for us. And the show uses this a lot. It's just the same as like when we find out Dean gave Cass a mixtape. Well, we never saw him give it to him, but boy, when he tries to give it back, it becomes obvious that he clearly did at some point. And so, yeah, Sam and Dean may have had this whole other aspect of their lives that we never ever even got to see at all, really. But it sort of acts as a counterpoint to everything that Lucifer is trying to convince Sam of now. You've always been under our control. They're not your real family. I always was. You were always running towards me. No, this is showing us, look, we may have seen Sam and Dean argue a lot in the show or be at odds with one another, but there was way more times when they were on the same page. And they would just park the car in the middle of nowhere, sit on the hood, and watch the stars. Then it cuts back to Chuck typing all of this when his phone rings. Chuck answers with Mistress Magda. And Dean's like, no, Chuck. Chuck's like, oh, Dean, I didn't know you were going to call. It's like, well, that's a dumb thing for the prophet not to know when he's literally writing this book. Yeah, no, he's too focused on crafting the story around the Impala to notice what Dean's up to. Dean's like, who's Mistress Magda? And Chuck moves his whiskey glass on top of the Mistress Magda ad. It's clearly a brothel. As if Dean could see it through the phone. Or if Chuck had to hide it from himself, even, to convince himself to say, oh, she's just a close friend. And all I can think is, what, you got Mary Magdalene on speed dial or something? Dean's like, whatever happened to Becky? And Chuck's like, it didn't work out. I had too much respect for her. Dean informs Chuck that Sam said yes, and Chuck's like, yeah, I know. And then after a beat adds, I saw it. And it's like, yeah, I think you know just because you know. God knows everything. Anyway, he should have known Dean was going to call. Dean is asking for the location of the final battle. And Chuck's like, the angels are keeping it really top secret. But I saw it anyway. Perks of being a prophet. And it's almost like Chuck is deciding where it's going to go down, like as he says it. Tomorrow, high noon, a place called Stull Cemetery. And Dean recognizes that name because it's near Lawrence, Kansas. And just watching Chuck react to Dean's questions. He's like, why Lawrence? And Chuck's like, it all has to end where it started, I guess. And he just looks so damn shifty when he says it. I cannot unsee Chuck as God, you know? It's impossible now. Dean asks if there's any way to stop this from happening. And Chuck's like, besides the rings? No. And then Dean asks if Chuck has any idea what's going to happen next. And Chuck's like, I wish I did, but I just don't know yet. And I think as the writer here, and as the crafter of this story, I really don't think Chuck knows what's going to happen next. Because, you know, Sam may have felt that they didn't have any other choice other than for him to say yes, but Dean still has choices. He could have listened to Cass and Bobby, like, we all knew this was going to be pretty hopeless. We'll just have to sit here and wait for the world to end. But Dean refuses. And I think that was the final test here. What will Dean do in the circumstance where he is basically in Chuck's shoes, where Chuck locked Amara away and Chuck locked Lucifer away and Chuck, you know, he is in Chuck's position here. And that's why Chuck identifies with him so much in later canon. Because Dean has to make the same choices. And the whole story hinges on what Dean decides to do. Not that there's any legitimately good choices, but of the choices he has, Dean does the best damn job he can. Dean gets out of the car and Bobby and Cass are walking over. Bobby's like, are you going to do something stupid? You got that look. Dean tells them, I'm going to go try and talk to Sam. And Cass has a very realistic and concerned view on the subject. He's like, you weren't able to reach him here. There's even less chance you'll be able to on the battlefield. And Dean's reply is the equally logical, well, if we've already lost, then I guess I have nothing to lose by going, right? And Cass makes one final plea. He gets why Dean feels the way he does. He's also like, there's only one thing you're going to see out there, and that's Michael killing your brother. And he looks heartbroken on Dean's behalf. Like, I don't want you to have to suffer that as your final moments on Earth, you know? And Cass learns a lesson in humanity and love, because Dean replies, well, then I ain't going to let him die alone. Like, we're all going to die anyway. I can at least do this one last thing. And Cass will someday make a similar offer to Dean, to go with him to face down against Amara when he thinks Dean is going to die, in a I don't want to let you die alone way. He will finally come to understand that, but man oh man, it takes him a while. And even then, Dean is like, no, I need you to live for me. There's a major shift in what winning is supposed to look like. And it's not about not dying alone. It's about living together. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to the abject failure of this to be a happy ending when we get to the ending. But we still got like 15 more minutes. Dean is going to do what Dean is going to do with or without the support of Cass and Bobby. Apparently it takes until noon the next day for him to reach Stull Cemetery. Lucifer had already arrived wearing Sam when Adam flies in. Well, Michael wearing Adam. They start off talking like, it's good to see you. And part of me wishes we didn't have to do this, says Lucifer. When Michael agrees, Lucifer's like, then why? Why are we doing this? Michael just stoically reminds him, you know why. It's our destiny. Michael insists that he doesn't have a choice. Again, least favorite phrase in the whole series. Because of what Lucifer did. Lucifer's like, think about it. It's not my fault. God made everything, including me. He made me this way. He wanted the devil. So why do we have to fight? Lucifer is emphasizing that they don't even know what the point of all of this is. What's going to happen when one of them kills the other? It's just another one of God's tests for us. Why don't we just walk off the chessboard? We're brothers. We don't have to do this. Michael thinks about it for a moment and he's like, I'm sorry, I can't. I have to do this. I'm a good son. I'm loyal to our father. You're the disobedient one. You want me to disobey now too. I can't do that. And it makes you wonder. Just to take a little pause here, Lucifer was all gung-ho on all of this having to happen because it's always been written and blah, 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 just the same as Michael was, until he got into Sam. I think that the vessel actually does color an archangel's, or probably any angel's, thoughts and feelings. And however much the angel accepts that influence from their vessel, since they're sharing a body and a brain and thoughts and emotions and feelings, is up to the individual angel. For some reason, Sam is fighting like hell. He's trying so hard to stop all of this. Like, he hasn't let up fighting back against it. And I think that's powering Lucifer to even suggest any of this. That's Sam fighting in there. And then you have Adam, the vessel of Michael. Adam, who was made a promise, you do this thing, you cooperate, and you will get this particular reward. You'll get your mother back. Adam was betrayed. He realizes he was lied to, but the promise still holds. If he can just get through this, if he can just live up to his end of the bargain, who knows what Michael has promised him now? You know, sit down, shut up, and you'll get your end of the deal. But Adam had no special love for the Winchesters, not even for John. He was just like, he was just some guy who took me to a baseball game once a year. You know, he wasn't even a dad to me at all. he doesn't have any emotional connection to them aside from knowing that Sam and Dean risked their lives to save him when they knew what was going to happen to him and he should have listened to them and trusted them. But instead he listened to and trusted the angels. So I don't know how much good feeling Adam even has towards the Winchesters at this point, but it's probably less than zero, but not enough for him to have any specific motivation to stop this. Like, he's all in now. He's kind of screwed over now. May as well go through it and hopefully come out the other side, and maybe Michael will be loyal and honor his promises. So I don't know how much pushback Adam is giving any of this, you know? But Sam, who's been fighting this his whole life, yeah, he's fighting like hell. And I'm wondering, if Dean had said yes to Michael, would Dean's influence over Michael have been powerful enough to get him to agree to walk off the chessboard? So in that way, no matter how this turned out for Chuck, it was an interesting story for him. And a very small handful of choices made by Sam and Dean along the way made the plot that much more exciting to him, because he didn't know exactly what was going to happen with these variables that the Winchesters threw in, but he still managed to tell the same thematic ending regardless. One brother sacrificed, the other brother able to carry on and have a life, however hollow that might look. And that was unsatisfying to Chuck. It came out how he wanted, and yet it wasn't enough. And there was still a wild card on the chessboard, Cass. Well, we'll get there. I just needed to point out how vessels can influence the angel possessing them. Because I think there's a distinct chance that that's at least implied by what their reactions are. The final straw for Michael was that Lucifer apparently made God leave. And Lucifer reacts angrily to that. No one makes Dad do anything. And that's so true. He may have used it as an excuse, put some extra blame on Lucifer, but Chuck does what Chuck wants to do. Lucifer and Michael agree that they're going to fight each other to the death, begin circling one another, and then are distracted by the Impala starting up and revving. So, like, was the Impala just sitting there, turned off, and Dean just watching all of this unfold, and neither of them noticed the car sitting there with Dean staring at them from outside the cemetery gates this whole time? Like, really? Really, guys? You're that dumb that you're surprised that Dean is sitting there? Inside the car, he pops a tape into the tape deck, and the tape is labeled, "Kick It in the Ass." Little tribute to Kim Manners there. Unfortunately, the song they choose is Rock of Ages by Def Leppard. And dear God, why is this the supposed peak of the show, that Kripke era, and that it just sort of like, yeah, okay, that just says everything I needed to know about Eric Kripke as a person. But as you read this scene in the script, and I suggest everybody do it because, oh my God, he's just like, yeah, we're kicking it in the ass. Yeah, with Def Leppard. Okay. Okay, chum. You know, pat him on the head. Okay, dear. Sorry, Def Leppard fans. Okay. Moving on. Dean takes a very long drive into the cemetery, past the windmill that will be used other times in the show, including where he finds Benny's bones buried in the opening episode of season 8. And I believe that was the same windmill that was used on the set of Hellraiser's 2, The Reckoning. But Dean just slowly trundles through this graveyard, just long enough for the opening bars of the song to play, and then he stops right in front of Michael and Lucifer. And he's just like, sorry, am I interrupting something? Dean walks right up to Lucifer and is like, hey, we need to talk. And Lucifer just sneers at him like, even for you, this is a whole new mountain of stupid. Dean's like, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to Sam. Lucifer uses Sam's face to give him a, oh, you poor baby, look. Michael interrupts and's like, you're no longer part of this story. And I like and appreciate that Michael is acknowledging it's a story that he's a character in, because he's the loyal son who follows the father's script. Dean attempts to apologize to Adam, if Adam can hear him in there. He's like, I'm so sorry this happened to you. And when Michael starts walking towards Dean like, you maggot, you're not part of this story. That's when Cass butts in with, hey, ass butt, and flings a holy fire Molotov cocktail at Michael. And from everything we know about archangels, they cannot cross holy fire, yet Michael apparently can be Molotoved with it and survive. This never made sense to me, that Michael was able to come back and that Adam wasn't dead and in heaven after this point. Like, I spent a decade believing that Adam was dead and in heaven after this, and that he never went to the cage. Because why would he? If Jimmy died when Cass was exploded, why would Adam not die when Michael was exploded? And honestly, why didn't Michael die from this? That should have theoretically killed him, but it didn't. So why was Gabriel afraid to cross holy fire? Why was Raphael afraid to cross holy fire? Explain why it has zero effect on Michael. I mean, obviously it disappears him, but he comes right back. It's not like, I guess maybe because Chuck pulled the same thing he did with Cass at the end of this episode, kind of holding him in reserve to throw him right back down onto the playing field, because that's where Chuck wanted him. Cass wasn't supposed to be the one to end this fight, you know? Dean looks over at Cass and is like, ass butt? Like, that's what shocked him? And Cass just shrugs like, I don't know, it was what came to mind. But Lucifer is outraged. Did you Molotov my brother with holy fire? Cass tries to deny it, even though we all just saw him do it. He shrugs and laughs, and then Lucifer just explodes him. Exactly as we were told that Raphael exploded him one season ago to this day. But we finally have video footage of what it would have looked like, and unfortunately, that gets used anytime it's mentioned that Cass was exploded by an archangel for the rest of canon, as if it was the only time it ever happened, and as if it was the time that Jimmy died. And we all know it happened a year ago as well, exactly like this. And remember, Cass is human this time, or close as, he's sleeping and eating and has no angelic powers. But Dean is horrified. He's just watched his friend, who sacrificed and risked everything to help him and gave him the best chance he had of getting to talk to Sam, and he sees him killed for it. Dean walks over to Lucifer and is like, Sam, can you hear me? Are you in there? And Lucifer is just in full control and furious with him. He's like, I tried to be nice to you, but no, you were just being a pain in my ass. And it's like, well, 5 minutes ago, you didn't even want to go through with this apocalypse and you felt dragged into it and you wished it could go another way. And Dean is literally trying to give you another way for it to go and you won't take it. So how much is it really about Lucifer wanting to walk away, and how much is it about Sam wanting to walk away from this? You know what I mean? So he throws Dean against the car. His head shatters the windshield. And then Bobby shoots at Sam from behind, hits him in the shoulder, trying to stop him from hurting Dean. It's not going to hurt him for real because, you know, archangels aren't bothered by bullets. But boy, are they ever pissed off about getting shot. Sam turns around. Bobby shoots him right through the heart. Does nothing, of course. And Lucifer's just like, twists his hand around, and it snaps Bobby's neck. And Dean screams, no. And Lucifer's like, yes. And then he just starts beating the crap out of Dean. And it kind of makes you wonder, how long has Sam wanted to do this? Like, it takes a lot for Sam to hate doing this and fight back. But no matter how many times Lucifer knocks him down, Dean keeps standing back up. He's like, all but ignoring the physical punishment he's taking. And he's just trying to plead with Sam directly. Can you hear me in there? You gotta fight back. But Lucifer is enjoying torturing Dean. and forcing Sam to endure it, that it's his fists that are doing this to his brother. It's like he enjoys that aspect of it too. No matter how much Sam hurts him, or Sam's body at least, you know, Sam's still in there. Dean's like, it's okay. I'm not going to leave you no matter what. I'm not holding any of this against you. I know this isn't you. And Sam is just about to deliver what would likely be a death punch when the clouds break and sun glints down on the side of the car and a bright glare reflects into Sam's eye. And something about that is mesmerizing enough to him that it allows Sam to break through. It's almost like that little reflective moment that bounces right into Sam's eye is what gives Sam the power to take back control. Where did that little reflective glare come from? Because without it, Dean would be dead now, and Sam would be waiting for Michael to return to battle it to the death. That is some well-timed glare. But he sees his reflection in the car window immediately after, and that's how Lucifer was letting Sam talk back earlier. So the reflection is part of what triggers this. He then notices the army man still jammed in the backseat ashtray of the Impala. And it triggers a lifetime flood of memories that pushes Lucifer out. And we get shots of the entire series, just flashes of them happy, sad, angry, playful, joyful, downtrodden, like the entire spectrum of human emotions we get in flashes. And Sam's fist unclenches, and it's clearly no longer Lucifer in control. Sam tells Dean, as Dean lies broken against the side of the car, it's going to be okay. I've got him. And he pulls the rings out of his pocket, throws them on the ground, says the spell, and the ground opens up into a pit, straight to the cage. And Dean's just watching this happen, too hurt to get up and do anything to stop Sam or change any of this. To him, this is the ultimate loss. No matter what else happens, he's lost his brother forever to this torture pit. He's condemned his brother to a literal eternity in hell. Sam takes one last look back at Dean and gives him a nod like, yeah, it's all good. And he's looking down into the pit, psyching himself up to jump when Michael returns and yells, Sam, because he knows it's not Lucifer in control anymore. And Michael is like, it's not going to end this way. Step back. Like, we have to fight each other because it's the law or whatever. Whatever dumbass thing Michael believes. And Sam's like, you're going to have to make me. Michael's like, well, okay then. And Sam drags him into the pit too. At least, you know, he'll have company. And it's like, well, if Sam hadn't been so dramatic about slowly holding his arms up like he was going to reverse swan dive into the pit, you know, if he just stepped back and cannonballed it instead, Michael may not have been able to stop him. Might not have gotten dragged down there, but again, at least now Sam's got somebody to chat with down there other than, you know, the angry archangel. And as soon as the two of them disappear, the ground magically seals itself back up, and Dean is just left there alone. His brother gone forever to hell. Bobby apparently dead. Cass apparently dead. And Dean too broken to even stand up and climb back into his own car. But hey, at least they averted Michael's destiny of carrying out the apocalypse and destroying all of creation. So, screw destiny in that respect. We return to a shot of Dean kneeling over the rings because he's too busted to stand up, I think. And like, yeah, they saved the world, but at what cost? And how happy is this really of a victory for Dean? And he glances up and Cass is now standing behind him. Dean's shocked. He's like, you're alive. Cass is like, yes, I'm better than that. He taps Dean on the forehead and heals all of his wounds, and better than just alive, Cass is an angel again. I don't know if that's better in this circumstance, considering everything that happens in season 6, but I don't think Cass is wrong about all of these being punishment resurrections, especially this one. Dean gets to his feet and kind of in awe, and he asks Cass if he's God. And Cass is like, oh, that's a nice compliment, but no. And I don't think it's a compliment. If you know anything about Dean, or God, for that matter, it's not a compliment. And Cass says, but I do believe he brought me back, new and improved. And originally, some people were like, oh my God, he must be an archangel now. I mean, there's almost like a roll of his eyes as he says that line, like new and improved. Yeah, I'm back to being an angel again. Just as he was beginning to adjust to being powerless. Then he walks over to Bobby and heals Bobby. And that's what Dean's left with. The rings in his hand, Cass back to being an angel, and Bobby alive, but Sam? That's where Chuck's narration picks back up. And we are told by the author what to think of the story at this point. Endings are hard. They really shouldn't be, Chuck. It's beginnings that are hard, dumbass. Kind of writer are you? But the way Chuck talks about the story here is, you try to tie up loose ends, but you never can. Fans are always going to bitch. There's always going to be holes. And then he just goes on to complain about, yeah, endings are just the worst. Because it's all supposed to add up to something at the end. And Chuck just sucks at that. And I'm going to go and throw in Kripke kind of does too. just for the hell of it. Because this could have added up to so much. And yet it doesn't. There's no win at the end of this. It's just depressing. Nobody gets anything that they want. And I understand, in fiction, getting everything you want is ridiculous and unbelievable and unsatisfying even. But getting nothing? I mean, yeah, they stopped the apocalypse, but on a personal level, they have less than nothing. They don't even have what they started out with. Dean has cut all ties with everybody, including Bobby. There's no going back to check on Sam because he's in a hole in hell. Dean doesn't even have hunting to fall back on as something to give him purpose and feel like he's doing something good in the world. He doesn't have any of that. All he has is a hollow promise he made to Sam, his dying wish to go to Lisa and ruin her life and ruin Ben's life and the lives of everybody who lives in any neighborhood they ever live in. And I'm sorry, it's just in fucking infuriating. And yes, you could say that's Sarah Gamble's story, but it's Kripke's story too. He helped her all through season 6 craft that entire story arc. So it's Kripke's story too. And Dean doesn't even have Cass at the end of it all. He asks Cass what he's going to do now, and Cass is like, well, I guess I will return to heaven. It's probably anarchy up there with Michael in the cage. Dean's like, oh, so you're the new sheriff in town? Cass is like, I suppose so. Like, he's amused by that title. Oh, poor thing, that's going to change so fast and so hard. Dean, however, is kind of bitter about that. Like, oh, you get a shiny new set of wings after having been essentially human, and suddenly you're God's bitch again. Okay. Like, didn't we learn this lesson? That's a terrible thing. And Cass is like, I have no idea what God wants of me, but he brought me back for a reason. And this is why I get so angry and bitter at Cass and at Dean for never saying, hey, look, you've got a reason. It's always because we care about you as a person. Not just because, oh, there must be some cosmic purpose to my return. It's part of the grand plan or whatever. Like, it's too close to, it's my destiny for my comfort to feel good, you know? Dean is still angry at God. He's like, tells Cass, if you see God, you tell him I'm coming for him next. Like, he never should have put any of us through this. And he didn't lift a finger to help. Well, I think he was that glare in Sam's eye that allowed Sam to take back the power to do everything. I mean, considering Chuck was writing this whole story. Yeah. Cass is surprised at Dean's anger at God. He's like, you know, he helped, maybe even more than we realize. I'm just sitting here thinking, yeah, the glare in Sam's eye. He allowed Sam to take control of the vessel because that's the story he wanted. Dean's like, that's easy for you to say, he brought you back, but what about me? What do I get? What's my reward? My brother in hell. Cass is like, you got what you wanted. No paradise, no hell, no apocalypse, no winner or loser. Just more of the same. The world continues to spin. Then Cass asks, I mean it, Dean. What would you rather have, peace or freedom? And it's always struck me as a weird question here, because the alternative, if they had allowed the apocalypse to play out, wasn't peace. I mean, Dean's now free to do whatever. He gets no peace. But Kansas lied to this point. There is no peace when he's done, just like there wasn't at the series finale. It's pretty much the same episode, but reversed. It's so bad. Oh my God, so bad. Anyway, but it's a stupid question on the face of it. Which would you rather have, peace or freedom? Because it's not like there's only two choices here. And it's not like either one was an option of the result of the apocalypse if Michael and Lucifer had fought and destroyed the world. Would that have been peaceful? Would the result of that battle and destruction be everybody at peace in heaven? Or hell on earth if Lucifer had won, apparently? I don't think that would have been peaceful. But death is peace. You know, it's the end of freedom. And it's part of the reason why I'm just so anti heaven is ever a good ending for them. Because they never got to live past the story. They never got to actually win freedom from Chuck's narrative. You don't get that in heaven. You get peace in heaven. I'm just being grouchy about 1520 now, if anyone can tell. But it's basically the same story in verse. Except Cass is sucked into the empty, so he can't bring Dean back the way he brings Sam back. So 1520 is actually worse than this. Dean thinks about that for a moment, and he looks back over at Cass like he's going to give some sort of an answer or reply. And Cass is already gone. Dean's like, man, you really suck at goodbyes. And he's alone. And the Americana theme kicks in, slow piano. And it's just so dang sad. Dean drives back to Bobby's, fixes up the Impala, and then leaves. And he doesn't talk to Bobby again for a long, long time afterwards, says Chuck's voiceover. Bobby keeps hunting, but not Dean. Dean apparently, according to Chuck, didn't want Cass to save him. Every part of him either wants to die or find a way to bring Sam back. But he isn't going to do either because he made a promise, says Chuck's narration. A terrible, disgusting promise to Sam to go find Lisa and beg her to take him in. So that's what he does. Even though we know from next season that Dean never stopped fighting to try and find a way to save Sam, even if Cass wasn't answering his prayers and wasn't interacting with him at all, Dean has no idea that Cass already brought Sam back for him and thought everything was okay when he went back to heaven. And he was just really, really wrong about all of it. When Lisa answers the door, she's like, oh, thank God you're all right. I guess she'd been seeing the wacky ass news, you know, earthquakes everywhere. She knew that something truly terrible was going down. And it's probably at least a minor relief for Dean to be back and she can finally get some answers out of him about what the hell had just happened. And he'll probably eventually tell her most of that story, but she does let him come in for a beer and she is there for him in a way that literally nobody else is for the next year. She basically kept him going, saved his life, gave him a reason to live. It never should have been a burden on her to do that. But she is absolutely a saint for taking him in. Because if he'd showed up on my porch and been like, the devil dragged my brother to hell, and you know, I would have been like, okay, maybe you should be out there fighting monsters. Get the hell away from me. So good on Lisa for, or I don't know, maybe concern for her for being brain damaged enough to let him back in the house with her son. Anyway, And he asks, if it's not too late, I'll take you up on that beer. And she replies with a smile, it's never too late. And I just had a flashback to 13.5 and the very, very end. It's never too late to start all over again. So now I'm going to be singing that song in my head for the rest of the night, which is probably just fine. Anyway, as Lisa and Dean hug, and you can see just how broken Dean actually is. He put on a charming face to win Lisa over, but man, now you can just see the hurt in his eyes as they pan back out. Chuck's like, so what does it all add up to? I'd say it was a test for Sam and Dean. I think they did all right up against good and evil and angels and demons and destiny and God himself, says the author, Chuck, God himself. They made their own choice. They chose family. And it's like, how much of this was their own choice? Just because Dean refused to back down. They didn't really have choices about how to end this apocalypse. And did they choose family, or did they fight for their family and yet lose it all anyway? Chuck goes on about how isn't that really the whole point? He's like, yeah, endings are hard, but nothing ever really ends, does it? And he just disappears, wearing that white shirt, making it clear that he's not just the prophet, that he's got more power and control over this story, even if he's vanished from it now. And that's Kripke, the one who had control over the whole story the whole time, gives himself a little pat on the back as he writes. Back at Lisa's house, Dean is sitting down with them at dinner, drinking a shot of whiskey, and Lisa asks if he's okay because he's just kind of staring off into space, and Dean's like, yeah, I'm good. It's clearly not good. The camera pulls back away from the window up to a light post, and the light flickers out, and as the camera drops back down to the ground, we see Sam standing beneath it, just staring back at Dean through the window as thunder sounds in the distance. And that is how the episode ends. That is how season 5 ends. How Kripke era ends. And I'm glad that bit of the show is over. I know some people are like, those are the only 5 good seasons. Like, dude, did you even watch this episode? It sucks. Come on. It's so dumb. Nobody gets anything good. It's not beautiful. It's not, oh, they did it because, you know, they loved each other so much. No, it's dumb because free will completely did not win. Yes, they were able to avert the apocalypse and save the world, but it's just depressing as fuck. Like, they didn't win anything other than that. They didn't get any peace personally. Nobody got what they wanted here. Not Cass, who feels now obligated to go back to heaven and play sheriff, even though Raphael's still up there, you know? An archangel's still up there who still wants the apocalypse to happen and is kind of resigned to it and just is so exhausted he doesn't want anything else. Can't be at all fussed to change his mind and think maybe God actually does want this. Because God didn't come back. That was supposed to be what happened. God was supposed to come back and reward them for completing the apocalypse. God didn't come back. Disappeared entirely. So they obviously have not done it correctly. He needs to finish the job because the angels just want God to come back. They feel abandoned. It's like God has no intention of coming back. He's got on the bus and left. He's more interested in watching Dean. Anyway, I don't really care for this episode, if that's not entirely clear. I mean, the acting's great. The directing's great. Chuck's a pompous git. Self-congratulatory bullshit when, you know, he thinks this was a great, heartening ending and, you know, should have been satisfying to the audience or whatever he imagines is his audience. But holy shit, how is that satisfying? Even if they had gone with one of their other alternate theories on an ending, like, they already knew the show was renewed for season 6 when they began writing this. But there's rumors that there were alternate thoughts on maybe Cass really could be God and that's how we'll get him to reveal that fact, or if it had actually been the ending of the series, Sam would not have come back at the end there. Like, there were other possibilities of what could have happened if this was truly the ending and they didn't know already that they were being renewed, or they wouldn't have filmed it in a serious to be continued manner with Sam popping up with no explanation for his return. So this was never intended to be the series finale as it aired. They knew they were getting at least one more season, so it's not even good on that level. I will, however, say that I do actually like season 6. It's not terrible. So, I mean, I like it better than some of the later seasons. Anyway, since I've already started even talking about it already, I will stop here to say a short disclaimer on the possibility of a temporary hiatus to this podcast over the next few weeks. Kind of having a family emergency situation that is kind of ongoing, so not really an emergency, but more like we know something's happening, but we don't know when. And so it's kind of like, so I'm going to just have to like drop everything and leave. But I will make an announcement of when I know when I'm going to be gone for a while, but I'll probably miss a couple of weeks. Anyway, I don't have any more brain power for anything I wanted to say about this one. Other than fuck Chuck, this was basically the inverse of 1520. So if you fucking hate 1520 and you like this episode for some reason, I'd like to study you for science. Because they're mirror images of one another. Until next week, when we can move right the fuck along past this episode. You can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPNGeorge, or you can find me on Discord at Mittens #4865, or you can email me at MittensMorgul@gmail.com, and I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. I never really, like, loved this episode. It was serviceable. It tied up Kripke's main overarching plot of the apocalypse and opened another door for season 6. But it's not the end of some grand narrative unless you're into depressing as fuck. And if you look at this episode carefully, free will did not play a big victorious role in this one. They made choices, sure, but it was like, we don't have any other choice kind of choices. Like, what else are we supposed to do except go throw tomatoes at Lucifer? We don't have any other options available other than to sit here and just roll over and die. Let's keep standing up and fighting. That was literally the only choice they had left. And so that's what they did. And I mean, that's exactly how they end up defeating Chuck. Or they think they're defeating Chuck. Chuck finally realizes that, wow, all I have to do is be the one to roll over and die, apparently. And they'll think I'm dead. And it's that easy, because they won't stop standing up. No matter how many times I knock them down, they're going to keep standing up. Oh, and that's just depressing as fuck. Free will never wins in Supernatural, even though it's like the literal one thing that they're all fighting for right to the end. Until they're not, because they don't think they have to fight for it anymore. They think they got it. And that's when they lose it. Anyway, now I'm just disappointed again. I'm going to go sing Steppenwolf in my head and feel better about things, I guess. I guess at least, you know, if you're watching this on the Blu-ray or the DVD, at least you got the gag reel to watch next. That's something. Have a good one, everyone.